lights flashing all around it, and underneath,
Enno ghosts are real.
You've been talking about Sasquatches and Yeti.
Yellow, orange object straight ahead.
This is the Paranormal Report.
Welcome to the Paranormal Report. I'm Jim Harold, and he is...
Micah Hanks. How are you, sir?
I am doing well. I'm doing well. Ready for a bunch of paranormal content here. But I will say this, Micah. People say, you know, this new audio podcast, and I'm enjoying it. People are enjoying it, but they say, sometimes I miss it. But you know what? There's an easy way to fix that.
And how's that?
Ba-dum-bum. I'll tell you exactly, folks. You can subscribe to this in your favorite podcatching software. I know we have some Android people, so if you use things like Pocket Casts, Casts, different ones, you can subscribe for free. And certainly if you're in the Apple universe, so you use an iPhone, an iPad, an iPod, or your good old computer on iTunes, just subscribe for free. And I love that. And I think in this day of streaming and everything, Micah, people forget. And they don't realize you subscribe for free just by pushing that subscribe button in your favorite podcatching software, if that's a podcast app on an iPhone or iTunes or whatever it might be. And then you never miss an episode. And I think that's such a smart way to go.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah, you know, it's funny because you and I are both, I think, is invested in the podcasting side of all this, as we are any of the kind of subjects we talk about on our shows.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the podcasting thing, you know, I really try to keep up to date on all the knowledge out there, how people are doing it. And I'm going to tell you, when it comes to the actual art of podcasting, there is, as you know, no one way that is the approved, this is how to podcast. Everybody can do it differently. And as far as obtaining those podcasts, downloading and listening to them, it's the same sort of thing. But it always boggles my mind a little, nonetheless, when people email me and they'll say, your shows are impossible to find on your website. I'm like, no, they're not. There's like a post right there at the top of the page. There's a player embedded. A guy emailed me and he said, there's no way to download them. And I said, yes, there is. Directly under the player.
Where it says download?
It says download. And he says, well, could you make it a little bit more visible like Mysterious Universe has? And I said, so I went over because, you know, I mean, I write for them. And I'm over there on their website all the time. So I hopped on over and I looked at the download. My download link is actually larger than theirs is. And people still claim they couldn't find it. And so sometimes I think that part of what it is that people, you know, I guess some people, you know, podcasting still being relatively new, they aren't hip to all the ways that you can obtain these shows. But yeah, by subscribing, which really, you know, again, if you're on iTunes, it's easy. You go to the iTunes store. You do a search for us. The Paranormal Report will pop up. We've only got one feed in there right now.
Yep.
And you can subscribe to it. And what happens is that submits that feed to your iTunes podcast list. And it just, and I know most people out there are already doing this, so bear with me. For those who have never tried this, you can subscribe and just get it sent to your iTunes or whatever podcatching client like Jim was talking about. And it's as simple as that. And you never miss a show. And so, you know, I definitely recommend that people do that. That's how I like to listen to podcasts, you know?
Absolutely.
And it's the way of the future.
Yeah, it's kind of like a package of paranormal goodness delivered at your feet for free every week. Why wouldn't you take that? So hit subscribe. We certainly would be interested in it.
And also, by subscribing, you know what? You're actually kind of helping us out, too, and I'll tell you how. Because, you know, we like to, like with any business, you want to know how much sales you're getting or whatever. You know, we're not selling anything with this show, but what we are getting is we're being able, by you subscribing, to more readily keep track of the numbers and how many downloads we get. And that actually helps us because we like to be able to say, hey, you know, we've got this many subscribers, we've got this many downloads this month.
Mm-hmm.
Those numbers are integral to anybody who's trying to get anywhere with what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And by producing this show, we need to know that people are listening. And that's another way you can kind of help us get those numbers so we can know who's listening, what's working, you know, what people enjoy hearing.
Absolutely. What a flash, Micah. What a flash. And there was another mysterious flash over Russia. Tell us what happened, because this is maybe not paranormal, or maybe it is, but it's kind of wild.
Well, it's open to suggestion. As a matter of fact, I'm going to say a little here, and then we're actually going to feature a video this week on our YouTube channel. So speaking of subscribing, you know, head on over to the YouTube channel this week, and Jim and I are going to feature a video talking about this. It's very similar to something that happened earlier this year, but this one actually is of this morning. RT reports that an inexplicable white and blue flash was spotted lighting up the sky over southern Russia near the city of Stavropol. Now, again, this is very similar to something that we have seen previously. We actually featured it on the Paranormal Report. It was a strange kind of orange-red blast that sorts of, you know, appears in the sky. But what's interesting about it is there was no sound associated with that one. nor the one that was reported by RT as of this morning, which is pretty odd because these things, they seem to be almost electrical in nature. And the first thing I thought as I'm looking at this is, okay, a transformer had blown. Well, this is what's interesting. They say, according to the Hydrometeorological Center of the city, the phenomena, quote, can't be attributed to nature, rather that it could be anthropogenic. In other words, that it's something man-made. Now, they say that the source of the light is thought to have been located somewhere on the ground. However, power engineers have rejected a version suggesting a fault in the power supply line, leaving the public clueless about the nature of the mysterious flash. And this isn't the first one, as we noted. So we'll feature that on the video section of our YouTube channel there at the Paranormal Report, and we'll maybe offer some theories about what we actually think could be happening here. But speaking of this, because it's looking like a big explosion minus the mystery boom, the likes of which are being reported all over the place. You know, Jim, you got another story that talks about something of a boom, but not the type that can't, you know, that happens here on Earth. Somebody's talking about off-planet explosions. What do we got?
Well, the gentleman is Dr. John Brandenburg. This story comes from us from the Daily Mail. .co.uk, dailymail.co.uk, that is. And apparently, Dr. Brandenburg, and this was written yesterday on the 17th, but apparently he was going to give a talk yesterday at a NASA conference, a NASA-sponsored conference, speculating that Martians were wiped out by a nuclear bomb. And talk about a bombshell. But let me give you a little bit of background of this gentleman before we get into it. Because you think, oh, this guy, he's way out there. He has a PhD in theoretical plasma physics from the University of California at Davis. Currently, he works as a plasma physicist at Orbital Technologies in Madison, Wisconsin. He has worked on a variety of propulsion technologies and previously was an independent consultant on space missile defense and directed energy weapons. And to kind of not bolster, but kind of put forth his theory, he has authored this book, which is his latest. It's called Death on Mars, The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre. So this guy has some academic gravitas, and he has done analysis of the surface of the planet of Mars. And he says that there's a thin layer of radioactive substances, including uranium, thorium, and radioactive potassium on the surface that supposedly provide evidence for his theory. And he says there's no other explanation for this than a weapons signature from an attack on Mars. Now, he goes on to say that he believes, and this is where he might lose me a little bit. He says that the ancient Martians were known as Cydonians and Utopians, and they were wiped out by a nuclear attack from another alien race. And, Micah, he also says, we better watch out. We might be next.
You know, there are some issues I have with this. Now, and I want to say, by the way, you know, in regard to his, you know, his background, you know, he's obviously, you know, someone who is educated in, you know, a lot of areas that would pertain to the theory that he is going to posit. The problem I have, of course, is that, you know, first of all, while we have sent probes to Mars, we have not been to Mars. We have not set foot, humans, on Martian soil. Now, some would dispute that, but, you know, I'm not going to get into the those theories, I think, espoused by the likes of Lynn Kasten and others in their books, you know, where we posit that there's a secret space program that our president, Barack Obama, was sent to Mars when he was, still a teenager. There's some pretty bizarre conspiracy theories about whether or not we've actually gone to Mars already. And even some respected, researchers in the field, friends of mine like Richard Dolan, would acknowledge that there is in likelihood a secret space program. Now, I've toyed with that idea before myself, Jim, and I've got friends high places, and people mostly who are engineers who have worked with the space program, and they probably wouldn't want their name associated with this sort of a subject, so I'm not going to bring that up. But you know, we discuss these sorts of matters from time to time. They're just as interested in this phenomena, but I think that they're often more skeptical by virtue of having worked with agencies like NASA and things like that over the years. And when these people talk with me about this sort of a thing, they'll say, look, you know, we can talk about black budgets and stuff like that, but, you know, from within, there is absolutely no evidence of some secret space program. And it would be extremely hard, extraordinarily, maybe impossible, in fact, to hide a space program knowing how much goes into the existing, space programs that are known to exist all around the world. If there was a secret space program keeping that from the public would be near impossible. So, you know, the question about whether we've gone to Mars to me is, well, we haven't been to Mars. We're still working on trying to get to Mars. That's why you read in the news every day about how we're trying to get to Mars. And Mr. Brandenburg, the only issue I see, first of all, is that, of course, having not been to Mars, this is still going to be, even though we can obtain samples and we can, you know, detect in a variety of ways radioactive elements, the likes of which are traces of them that he's discussing here, that is not in itself proof that there has been nuclear weaponry on Mars at some time in the ancient past. And there was a book, I believe, written called The World Without Us a few years ago, where an author speculated what would happen if for some, you know, instance, you know, there was a catastrophic, you know, anything that happened on Earth, whatever the circumstances may be, but humans die out, what would happen? Would nature reclaim evidence of human civilization? And he said that within, you know, 500 years that most evidence of civilization would be reclaimed. And of course, there would be certain things that would outlast time, you know, the likes of the pyramids, and we see ancient monuments that have actually done this. But much of the modern construction and evidence of human civilization would be less apparent, especially if being viewed from another planet, I think. And so the point I'm making is that, you know, if there were evidences of a civilization capable of harnessing the power of the atom, I would think that there would have to be some evidence still visible on Mars.
Well, two things. One is, I don't understand where he comes up with this idea of the Sidonians and the Utopians.
Yeah.
I don't know where that comes from. I don't know enough about his theory. Maybe he explains it in his book. In fact, I've had my intrepid part-time assistant to reach out and hopefully get him on one of the programs. I'm hoping to get a chance to talk to him so he can explain his theory. But I don't get where that comes from. Now, I do understand that he's saying that it wasn't their own nuclear development, but a third party alien race from somewhere else came and attacked them. So that's why he has the caution that that same race may be out there somewhere with us in their crosshairs. Sounds pretty fantastic to me. I am interested, though, in learning more because we always keep an open mind. I'm pretty skeptical, but I always want to hear the theories. Hopefully, we'll get to talk to Dr. Brandenburg soon. Now, we're still going to keep our eyes to the sky, but we're going to ratchet it down a little bit closer to Earth here. What are these strange snow geese who just fell out of the sky, Mike? I know it's your next story, and it's very strange.
Well, let me just say this, that I'm going to speculate here, but in likelihood, it was probably nuclear radiation from an alien civilization.
Could
that
be.
Geese. I'm still trying to fathom how we can prove that an alien civilization somewhere out there has launched a nuclear attack against Mars, but I digress. No, there's a much more Earth-based explanation for what brought these geese down over Idaho and onto the ground. I first saw this and I thought that maybe there was something akin to hypoxia. I do happen to know, for instance, that there was yesterday a fairly substantial mass coronal ejection that probably spiked, what is it, the KP index on planet Earth. I was actually reading that just this morning. And when that happens sometimes, if the geomagnetic sphere of planet Earth is actually affected by CMEs, it can actually upset the natural directional sense of certain, for instance, birds in flight, fish, a lot of animals that utilize a kind of a directional sense like that. And in some instances like that, birds have been known to fly off course, or they will ascend to a unhealthy altitude at which they suffer hypoxia and then fall back to the ground. So when I first heard about these geese falling to the ground, I kind of was thinking, okay, maybe this is what happened. They became disoriented and then probably suffered from hypoxia. That doesn't seem to be the case here, though. Apparently, there were 2,000 snow geese. They were migrating from Mexico to their Alaskan nesting grounds, as reported by the Washington Post, found dead in Idaho. And according to the State Department of Fish and Game, they say that these actually were the victims of an avian cholera, an actual bacteria. Yeah, they say that basically these birds just fell out of the sky. And furthermore, they were concerned that since it was an actual infection that had killed them, 2,000 of these birds, they had to collect and burn the carcasses, which were all found in the Mud Lake and Market Lake wildlife management areas in the southeast region of the state, because they didn't want any of this to spread. Now, interestingly, I do, as I understand, I think that people can actually contract this, but they say that it's highly unlikely and that it's not something that people generally need to worry about. But it is interesting to me that, that these birds numbering 2,000 actually were affected by this. It says it's not clear where the geese may have contracted the illness, but according to a spokesperson, they said that they noted the avian cholera has occurred sporadically in the region over the past few decades.
Well, it strikes me as interesting when you look at these kind of happenings and then you put them back in time. You know, 100 years ago, people, and maybe some people today in some cultures would say, oh, there's a curse or there's a bad omen. And I think it's always interesting, even though I do believe personally in the supernatural and some things, it's interesting when we can have these happenings that in past times would have been thought to be some kind of a curse, some kind of a bad omen, those types of things, and they can be explained by science, because you can imagine an indigenous people or people centuries ago, it would be quite frightening to find all of these snow geese just suddenly falling out of the sky for no reason. And it would be logical, using their knowledge of the time, that God was visiting some kind of curse on them. So it does, kudos for science for figuring this out, but still very, very disturbing when you see something like this.
Absolutely. Well, and think about, you know, the writings of Charles Fort.
Yes, yes.
Fortean literature is rife with reports of birds that, you know, fall, not just birds. I mean, we actually have fish that fall from the sky, frogs that fall from the sky. It doesn't seem that unusual that birds would fall from the sky, except for when we have 2,000 of them that just drop dead. But, you know, again, maybe even in the time of Charles Fort in his heyday, despite the fact that I guess that advances in bacteriology probably at that time even could have determined that there was something that had been a physical ailment that affected these birds. But, you know, even at that time, maybe the Fortean interpretation of it would have been, as had been posited from time to time by Fort, that an atmospheric life form had been preying on these things, or that something moving through the air had actually struck and killed all these birds. So, you know, we look at this, and yes, through science, we can, as I had put forth earlier, you know, I mean, there are a number of different varieties of scenarios that can lead to the death of birds like this. And, you know, again, I wouldn't be surprised if in the future we don't hear more about these kinds of things, if the sunspot situation that we're kind of following, you and I, intermittently, continues to be something that can affect wildlife here on planet Earth, which we know it does, and the directional senses of animals are affected by this sort of a thing. We may see this kind of a thing happening again in the future. And as was reported in the past, you know, that there's a totally different ailment, hypoxia in that instance, that that the birds succumbed to. Here we know it was something bacterial, not a Fortean mystery, but I think an interesting way to interpret through the lens of modernity the way that those old Fortean mysteries might have been looked at.
Yeah, very good point and interesting story. Now, another interesting story, kind of turning our attention to more ghostly matters, is something that I saw this week, New York Post reporting that 911 rubble was haunted by a female ghost. Now, I don't recall, and maybe I've just missed it, hearing a lot of stories of the World Trade Centers and hauntings and those kind of things. It would seem to make sense if you follow in that field of study and believe in hauntings, that someplace with a great deal of tragedy or sadness, that there would be some kind of manifestation if you believe in that sort of thing. And I guess now there is a story in a new book. The book is called From Landfill to Hallowed Ground. And apparently, while workers were sifting through the rubble from 911 at the time of this tragic, horrible attack, that they reported seeing a female ghost holding a tray of sandwiches. And this is in this new book, From Landfill to Hallowed Ground. The author is retired NYPD Lieutenant Frank Mara. And he said, I thought she was trying to help us, being first responders. Now, it gets even more interesting when you hear the description of this ghost. The specter was African-American, dressed in white in the style of a Red Cross worker during the Second World War. Mara himself said he saw her a few times, always more than 50 yards away, and each time as he strained to make sense of this vision, the lady vanished. And it wasn't just him, other people. For example, when he was conducting interviews for the book in 2013, a retired crime scene detective asked him, you ever hear stories about the old Red Cross worker trying to serve sandwiches and coffee out by the sifters? And it's interesting, Mara said he had lost this memory, and then he recalled it at that time when this gentleman asked him this question. Other people said that they saw this apparition and other strange visions like shadows and large black masses. A psychic medium who they consulted on this, Mara consulted, explained to him that this may have been a spirit called a soul collector guiding people to the afterlife. So, and this kind of harkens back to something we talked about last week, the third man syndrome. It's just interesting how people see these kind of things in high tension, tragic, frightening situations. Was it a vision from the afterlife? Was it a hallucination? If it was, it had to be a mass hallucination if we have multiple people reporting it. So one of those ones that makes you scratch your head and think, Micah.
Oh, yeah. When we look at the Tibetan interpretation of a thought form projected from within one's psyche, the term used for this being tulpa, you know, I see a lot of people in the paranormal community that, you know, kind of cite the tulpa as an explanation for a variety of different phenomena that are in.
David Weatherly's done a lot of work on that.
David has talked an awful lot about that, yeah, and which reminds me, I need to call him. And Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman even wrote a book called The Unidentified back in the 1970s, early offering, and I think that it's been it's back in print now. So I've got an original copy of it, and they kind of take that sort of an approach to understanding, you know, paranormal phenomena, even UFOs and Bigfoot and things like this, through the lens of, psychology, not psychosis, but psychology. Again, there's a distinct difference, and so I don't want people to be offended when I put forth the idea that I sometimes wonder if what are apparently ghostly apparitions, maybe not in all instances, but could they actually be akin to that third man factor like we talked about last week, in which a person might project something that is, I don't know, you know, some sort of a thought projection that appears to be a physical manifestation that is actually produced as a result of a necessity for feeling comfort or some sort of reconciliation with the environment or some other sort of environmental factor. You know, I'm totally speculating here, and I don't think that that's off base because, again, when we have these reports of people who feel that they have been accompanied by someone, you know, we have, for instance, this instance where this little girl was saved from drowning or from hypothermia by a disembodied voice, as reported by the workers that we've reported on. We've touched on a lot of stories that, if looked at through the lens of modern psychology, without leaping to any conclusions, I think that some might infer that there's a psychological phenomena here that we don't fully understand, which might account for some cases of paranormal phenomena. And I wonder about that in this instance too. Now, when you have multiple parties that are experiencing the same thing, yes, that does make it a little more interesting to me, in which case maybe, you know, hive mentality or, you know, crowd consciousness would have to come into play in terms of trying to reconcile that through the lens of modern psychology and this variety of paranormal seemingly phenomena being reconciled through aspects of the human mind that we don't yet understand. I wouldn't rule it out. And that to me is just as much a mystery as trying to understand anything like ghosts or Bigfoot or anything like that. You know, I don't know that we can leap to that conclusion. And I realize a lot of people who are experiencers themselves may be offended. So I don't want to say that that's what you saw. I'm merely suggesting that maybe in some cases there's a psychological component to it, which is an equal mystery, I think, or at least in equal measure as mysterious as the phenomena we discuss ordinarily on this program.
Or maybe it was a ghost.
Maybe it was a ghost, yeah.
You know, there's always that possibility as well. Well, since we're talking about things that may be real or may be imaginary, I guess some are speculating, it's a new word, I've invented it, speculating that Bigfoot may still be imaginary, according to the Washington Post, Micah.
Let me just give you the skivvy on this, because there have been a number of websites that have touched on this. What it all has to do with is the fact that, and this is good science, Brian Sykes, of course, produces this study. They say that they find no evidence, Brian Sykes, of course, of Oxford University, no evidence based on the hair samples produced for use in this study that a mystery primate exists. However, there is possible evidence supporting the existence of a polar bear cousin that was believed to be extinct, which may still exist in the Himalayas. So some interpret it as being that maybe there is a species of bear which has been behind the legend of the Yeti all along. And there have been articles as published as recently as yesterday and the day before that have presented that argument. And then we have the Washington Post, which, we have some very interesting articles we've touched on from the Post in the last few.
Yes, absolutely.
And this is one, the headline reads, Bigfoot, still imaginary, probably not an undiscovered species of bear. here's the good science. There was a secondary study that was carried out, which has now said that they think, rather than being a living hybrid between an ancient bear and another species, that the RNA results actually do not support or are not clear and conclusive enough to support the existence of this creature, and that in likelihood it may just be the old-fashioned Himalayan brown bear that this study is actually presenting information about. It says, in December, of course, I want to back up a little bit here. The Post reports that this other group of researchers claimed that the genetic analysis that Sykes' study performed was in error. The hair samples actually matched a rare subgroup of brown bear found in the Himalayas, known to exist. This bear is still probably related to the Yeti myth, they say, because of rarity and also because of its size, and it's nothing so exotic as an undiscovered relic of bears long past. According to those who authored the study, they said, quote, importantly for the thrust of the paper as a whole, the conclusion that these Himalayan Yeti samples were certainly not from a hitherto unknown primate species is unaffected. They say in a statement, they say, we stressed in the original paper that the true identity of this intriguing animal needs to be refined, preferably by sequenced data from fresh tissue samples derived from a living specimen where DNA degradation is no longer a concern. So, you know, the thing is that while the scope of the study had been to try and prove what or if there was a Yeti, keeping in mind, I think that some of the samples, though, may have been taken from North American locations as well, in which case many would draw the distinction between the supposed Yeti of the Himalayas and the Bigfoot of the North Americas. Even John Napier, I've brought him up many times, and the reason why is because as far as primatology goes, I really respect him, and he was an authoritative author on that Bigfoot subject in 1972. He said that based on the information in the historical record that he couldn't, or actually physical data for that matter, that he couldn't stand behind the Yeti, but he said he was convinced there was something to the North American Bigfoot. So I say first, draw a distinction between those two. The abominable snowman less and less seems to be something that there's evidence to support the existence of. I don't rule out Bigfoot, neither did Sykes. But the study is now saying that even the information that they presented in relation to a possibly, maybe we'll call it a living fossil or something similar to it, in relation to a bear species, that they may not be the case either. But let me bring one final question into play with this, because we've looked at the way that the media has treated this story differently from outlet to outlet, and this headline reading, Bigfoot still imaginary. Well, you know, again, Sykes said that we can't rule out Bigfoot, but that this study simply didn't support evidence of a mystery primate. But here we have even a bit of dialogue going back and forth on whether or not the RNA evidence that was produced in this study is being accurately read in relation to a species of bear. So could it be, and again, I'm no geneticist, and I said this last week on the Grailian Report, but being no geneticist, I would ask if they can't differentiate conclusively between bear species if something so close to human were presented and genetic evidence were forthcoming. Would we, without anything to compare that to, or could we possibly mistake that for being human when in fact it may be something else? I wish a geneticist in the audience would contact us. I'd love to hear from someone about whether or not something very close to humans, which is why I often bring up feral humans in relation to this discussion about Bigfoot, if it were so close genetically to humans and we have nothing by which to compare that apart from ourselves, would we mistake that in a genetic study for being human in that instance? As has been done with this, you know, sample that may or may not be, you know, a living fossil or something related to an ancient polar bear species. See, there's a lot of questions, I think.
That would be a great question for Todd Disotel, who we had on the Paranormal Podcast a few months ago. I'd love to ask him that question because, again, I think it's even interesting that there is a dialogue and, you know, a publication like the Washington Post is actually having a serious discussion on this. And it's kind of refreshing.
Again,
I think most of these publications will always err on the side of debunking to an extent, but I think it's kind of nice to see something that's not necessarily in the weird news section, you know, those kind of things, even though I had a podcast called that one time, but to see them more seriously treated and hopefully it's a harbinger of things to come. But I can tell you one thing, Micah, you talk about Bigfoot. Many people call it Sasquatch. I can tell you some people who really do believe in it.
Oh, yeah. This story that you brought up, really, go ahead and dive into this, because going from the skeptical, analytical, scientific side, let's go into the field with researchers who claim they've actually had an encounter. This story fascinates me.
Yeah, a couple of Sasquatch hunters near Houston, Texas, and this just in the last couple of days has been reported over at cron.com, which is basically the website of the Houston Chronicle. Sasquatch hunters near Houston say they were attacked by Bigfoot. Actually, the main person in this is actually a fellow podcaster, Wes Gurman, host of the Sasquatch Chronicle podcast. Well, his team ventured into the East Texas Piney Woods with the guide of Bob Garrett and Sons, a family of self-declared cryptozoologists who have tracked creatures through the woods north of Houston for years. And it turns out that apparently they met up with a Sasquatch, and the Sasquatch was not happy to see them. In fact, when they drew too close in the Sam Houston National Forest, apparently the Sasquatch got PO'd, positively outraged, and he hurled giant logs at the curious humans. Now, Germer on his podcast said that his heart was just pounding in his throat. Originally, he had heard some noise, something crashing through the bush, and he thought that one of his team members was making a racket, and he was upset because he thought that this would scare away the monster. Turns out it was the monster. He said that he noticed in the faint glow of lights far away a giant that bolted off and plowed fiercely through the dense brush with astonishing speed. He said this thing moved so fast, it probably covered 100 to 150 yards like nothing. And he said that the creature was just 30 to 40 feet beyond the tree line of the campsite, but the thicket obscured it entirely. He loaded his gun and ducked into the brush to catch a glimpse of the monster, but the glimpse never came. So this podcast host and his friends are saying they came one-to-one, face-to-face with Sasquatch, and Sasquatch wasn't happy.
Yeah. You know, I've spoken with some of the fine folks there at the Sasquatch Chronicles podcast, and Shannon LeGros, who's mentioned in the article there at thecron.com, you know, I consider her a good friend. And, you know, I find them to be people who are, you know, they have a certain degree of integrity and seriousness about this subject. So I know that, you know, probably people from outside the know, well, you know, would read a story like that, especially if they're skeptical of Bigfoot to begin with, and they would say, oh, come on, really? Okay, a bunch of squatchers, you know, imagining an experience out in the woods. You know, Sasquatch Chronicles is a fascinating show, and I recommend people go and listen to it. They certainly present, rather than the kind of an analytical approach to studying Bigfoot like I try to do through, you know, I consider it almost epistemological in the sense of philosophy, where how can we determine that we know what we know? And I've got textbooks on this subject right here behind me on this bookshelf. And I began looking at all this philosophically because I think that we have to look very carefully and logically at the evidence before us. That's my approach. They take a little bit more of the, you know, let's get into the field and let's find that hard evidence. And really, if you're going to satisfy science, that's what we need. And so I commend anybody who takes the subject that seriously. Now, let's talk about their encounter. They said that they had thought initially that it was one of their own team members. Then the sound of this person crashing through the brush was first annoying to Wes, because he said, yeah, I can't believe one of my people would make that much noise out here if we're trying to be quiet and keep a low key. And then he realized, but why aren't they carrying a flashlight? And that, you know, shortly afterward, that, you know, again, that there was what they heard. They said that it sounded almost like the sound of spinning blades on a helicopter in the distance. And then they realized that it was this log smashing through the trees, and it blast up against a tree right just a few feet from them. Here in Western North Carolina, where I live, there was a family over near Yellow Gap over in Madison County that had claimed that they had, on numerous instances, had basketball-sized stones thrown at them from up the mountain. And then on one instance that they'd actually seen a large person, but they said that there was no sign of clothing and that there was hair all over this thing that had been crouched, and that this is what they believed had thrown these stones at them. And furthermore, there was a gentleman who, he's a journalist, actually, who lives in North Carolina, or right here in Asheville. And he had reached out to me and asked if we could meet one night. And I got the impression, you know, that he was even a little nervous to talk about this. But he told me about how he had been a complete skeptic, had gone into the forest with, I believe it was the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, and was writing an article about this. He had been asked by Nature Magazine to do a write-up. And they'd asked him to be as tongue-in-cheek as he wanted to. Okay, go out there, go squatching. He said that during that experience in the forest, that the same thing happened to him, that he said that he'd been there with a couple of these guys, and that a stone about the size of maybe a softball whizzed by his head as thrown by something over here in the forest and smashed into the river right next to him. And he said, you cannot imagine the fear that you feel when you're in the forest and you realize that first that something is trying to attack you, and second that this something is capable of picking up an object and launching it in your direction. You know, there was another story that was sent along to me back in December by a gentleman. He is a retired lieutenant, I believe, in the U.S. military. And he had said that he and his friends, I think there were four of them, in the forests of Louisiana in 1976, that they'd been on post one night during a training mission, had become disoriented because it was obviously very dark at night. They wandered off of their post and had tried to get back to it and had to end up traveling toward this road so that they could just get off of the high, get out of the forest and try and get back to their base. And so when they made it to this blacktop road, they said that they had become aware of the fact that as they had been disoriented and wandering through the woods back toward this road that they knew existed, that something was following them, Jim. Huh. They said that it was 6 to 8 feet tall, walking upright, and had red eyes that reflected the lights that they were carrying. And it kept a distance, but they said that despite the distance, that there was a horrible smell associated with this.
I've had very similar stories told to me on the campfire. Very similar.
Yeah, you know, even John Keel referred to the red-eyed monsters from time to time. And they finally got to the road, and they said that after walking about a mile, that a car came along, and they waved them down, and that they got in, and the person gave them a ride back to the base. But they said that when they got in the car, the driver had said there was somebody or something following you. They said it looked shaggy and was covered in hair, and he said that it dove off into the woods, but he said, I saw it clearly in the headlights when I came up and saw you guys walking. And so the story was even published in a newspaper at the time, and he said, we all experienced it, and the gentleman's even said he'd like to talk to me about it at some point. I need to follow up with him about that. But the point is I, like John Napier, I don't think it's fair to be just rude and dismissive of people who claim they've had these encounters, because although it's circumstantial evidence, there seems to be some evidence that supports that what these people who enter the forest at night and experience what has happened has actually happened to them. And I've spoken to countless individuals, as you have, who've told these kind of stories. And to me, that isn't proof enough for science, and I recognize that wholeheartedly, but that doesn't rule out that people are actually experiencing something in these cases.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to say that Bigfoot, Sasquatch, whatever you want to call it, is an interdimensional traveler who beams himself in and out of particular locations. You lose me there. The idea that there might be an animal, a biped that we haven't discovered, and I think we've both said this before. Is it probable? Probably not. Is it possible? Yes, I think it is possible. And I think that it's an interesting subject to explore. And I'm going to kind of preempt myself here with a plug, but actually, on my Plus Club next week, March 23rd, we're going to be doing a video webinar, which is part of the Plus Club over at jimherold.net with Eric Altman. We're going to do part two of Bigfoot 101. Everything you wanted to know, but we're afraid to ask. And that's going to be an hour, and that's going to be on Monday evening. So if folks want to go and see part one of that webinar, along with all the other Plus Club content, and participate and ask Eric questions on the live webinar on Monday night, I would recommend they go over to jimherold.net. But it is a subject that continues to fascinate, particularly when you have people of good reputation and goodwill who make reports like this, Micah.
Absolutely. You know, glad we could end on that note because, you know, I think a little Sasquatch talk's always pretty fun. We appreciate people tuning in, listening to us, and hearing what we have to say on this program. You know, you can follow Jim and I on Twitter. You can subscribe to us on the YouTube channel, as well as, like we said at the outset of this show, you can subscribe to this podcast. And, of course, we've got websites just as well. I've got the Graylian Report, where we've got podcasts, and you can also find the Paranormal Report there. What's heading on over to jimherold.com? What's happening in your neck of the woods this week, Jim?
Well, we have next week we have that webinar I talked about, but jimherold.com just interviewed Laird Scranton.
Ah, yeah.
Our good buddy, Laird Scranton. And that is up right now. We talk about Göbekli Tepe, which is always a fascinating ancient site, which just seems to be expanding in interest and influence. And we have a wide-ranging discussion with him on the campfire. We have a bartender who met up with an interesting specter. And of course, we have our JimHerold.net Plus Club podcasts. This week we're going to be talking about the occult and other strange matters. So hopefully folks will check all of that out and check out Micah's stuff as well. And of course, go over to ParanormalReport.tv to subscribe to the YouTube channel, and as Micah so astutely said, subscribe to this very podcast so you never miss an edition. Well, Micah, I hope you have a great week, and may paranormal goodness find you.
Yes, absolutely. Nanu, nanu, live long and prosper. And of course, as I would say on Grayling Report, stay strange, Jim. We'll talk to you soon, and all of you, we'll talk to you next week. Catch us on the videos on YouTube, and thank you for, as always, listening to the Paranormal Report.
Bye-bye, and stay tuned.
There are several lights flashing all around it and underneath. And no ghosts are real.
You've been talking about Sasquatches and Yetis.
Yellow, orange objects straight ahead.
This is the Paranormal Report.